1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 325, Helen Mar Whitney's Difficult Conversion to Polygamy by Todd Compton, with comments by Martha Pierce.
I'd like to welcome you to session 325 of the 1997 Salt Lake Symposium. This is called Helen Mar Whitney's Difficult Conversion to Polygamy, presented by Todd Compton, who has a PhD in classics from UCLA and is author of a book forthcoming from Signature this winter titled In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith. Responding will be Martha Pierce, who is supervising guardian ad litem attorney at the Third District Court in Salt Lake and has a JD from the University of Utah. I'd like to remind you that admission is by registration only, and so if you haven't registered, you can do it right out there, and that this session will last 1 hour. There will be a few minutes for questions at the end.
Okay, on August 22nd, 1828, Helen Mar Kimball was born to Heber Chase Kimball and Valette Murray in Minden, Monroe, New York, 10 miles west of Palmyra. Heber, a 27-year-old native of Vermont, was a potter, a blacksmith, and a farmer. An unsophisticated man who mixed childlike faith, homespun wisdom, and abiding, jolly Yankee humor, he would become one of the most prominent leaders in early Mormonism. Valette, 22, had been born in New York. She was intelligent and cultured, and Heber regarded her with intense devotion. Helen was the third child in a family of 9 children and the only surviving daughter in the family. Her closest sibling was William, who was a couple years older than her. Perhaps as an only daughter, Helen was slightly pampered. One gathers that she was the apple of her father's eye, and throughout her life she looked upon him with profound veneration and affection. Quote, "I remember the cunning little dishes and toys he would make for me," end quote, she wrote, "which I generously divided with my mates who were less fortunate," end quote. She regarded her mother with equal reverence. Often she remembers she would awaken to hear Valette praying. Then her mother would begin performing her household duties, quote, "singing so sweetly it seemed to me as though heaven and the angels were not very far off. I used to think it impossible for me to ever become a saint. I looked upon my parents as such, but thought that nothing short of perfection would take us to heaven, which I could never attain to, as I was so fond of fun and amusement that I could not possibly give them up, though I often had very serious reflections upon the subject and used to think if I could only know just a little time before I was to die, I might be able to sober down and prepare myself." Okay, just one little anecdote to show the dynamics of Helen and her parents when she was a young girl. One day, Valette, when going out to make a call, gave Helen instructions not to touch the dishes, which she left standing on the table, and told her that if she broke any during her absence, she would give her a whipping when she returned. And, of course, we know what happened. Helen, playing under the table, bumped it accidentally, the table leaf fell, and a number of the dishes were broken. Quote, "My brother solemnly but needlessly reminded me of what I might expect," she later remembered. Horrified, she went out under a nearby apple tree and prayed that her mother's heart might be softened, that when she returned, she might not whip her. And though Valette was very punctual when she made a promise to her children to fulfill it, yet when she returned, she had no disposition to chastise her daughter. So Helen's prayer was answered. Heber loved to tell this story, says Helen, and, quote, "often he would turn to me with a sly twinkle and say, 'Here's Helen, she had to be whipped into obedience.' And I always admitted it, saying, 'Yes, who he loveth, he chasteneth,' when he would burst out into one of his peculiar laughs." Here we see Heber's wry sense of humor and affectionate rapport with Helen, and we see the tender-hearted Valette unable to administer the corporal punishment that had been promised her daughter. And I heard Stan Kimball give a very fine presentation on Heber C. Kimball, and he mentioned that J. Golden Kimball was the son of Heber C. Kimball, and people asked, did Heber have the same sense of humor? And he said that sometimes Heber C. Kimball was funnier than J. Golden Kimball. So I'm telling these stories just to show that Heber C. Kimball was a human being and that Helen was sincerely attached to him. Okay, they were converted to Mormonism, and were involved with the standard Mormon adventures. They were baptized in 1832. In 1835, Heber C. Kimball was called to be an apostle, along with Brigham Young, and the Young family was kind of like unofficial aunts and uncles in Helen Marr's family when she was growing up. They went to Missouri, went through the Missouri persecutions. Helen Marr was baptized in the middle of the winter. Heber Kimball cut a hole in the ice, and Uncle Brigham Young performed the baptism. Okay, they were driven out of Missouri and came to Illinois. Went through the hardships of Illinois, the malarial episodes. Valette continued to have children, and she was somewhat sickly, so Helen Marr, as the oldest daughter, kind of raised some of these younger children in a big family. One incident that sheds some light on her later conversion. Satanic forces now make an appearance in Kimball family history. Early Mormons often interpreted serious sickness as demonic possession, a perspective that figures importantly in Helen's life. When the Kimballs were still living in their first primitive house in Nauvoo, one night Valette began making strange noises. She dreamed of a personage attacking her and woke up Heber as she struggled with an invisible assailant. Helen writes, "Heber lit a candle and saw that her eyes were sunken and her nose pinched in. He laid hands upon her head and rebuked the spirit and commanded it to depart. However, as in the Bible, spirits can move into other bodies, including animals." Helen writes, "In a moment afterwards, some half a dozen children in other parts of the house were heard crying as if in great distress. The cattle began to bellow and low, the horses to neigh and winnow. The dogs barked, hogs squealed, and the fowls and everything around was in great commotion." In a few minutes, Heber was called to lay hands on Sister Bentley, the widow of David Patton, who lived in the next room. Through witnessing such scenes, the dark ideology of demonic possession took a firm seat in Helen's worldview. Heber finished a new house, but was soon called on another mission to England. He left on September 18, 1839, to fulfill a mission that would last 2 years. Helen wrote, quote, "We children wept bitterly when our father came to bid us farewell. Both he and Brother Young were going away so sick they were unable to get into the wagon without assistance. The scene is so vivid before me that my eyes are blinded with tears as I try to write." 2 years later, Heber returned home, and William, who lived near the landing, greeted him first, then ran home to tell the Kimball family. Helen writes, "Soon we saw a company of horsemen coming with all speed, and when my mother saw them, she made a hasty retreat behind the door to hide her confusion, where in a moment after father found her overwhelmed in tears. Joseph, with Brother Hiram and 3 or 4 brethren, accompanied my father home. My mother felt the presence of others at such a time almost an intrusion, but Brother Joseph seemed unwilling to part with my father, and from that time kept the 12 in council early and late, and she sometimes felt nearly jealous of him." So we kind of have the beginnings of the church widow syndrome in Mormon history here. But Heber C. Kimball became one of Joseph Smith's elite circle. In the fall of 1841, Joseph Smith wanted Kimball closer to him, so Heber built a house on the flat near to the temple, the meeting place in the grove, and the Mississippi. On March 22, 1842, Helen, now 13, attended the birthday party for Sarah Ann Whitney, 17, in the Masonic room above Joseph Smith's store. Helen was intimidated by the number of older guests, but was too shy to participate in games. After the party, though, she spent the night in the Whitney home. Sarah and Helen talked long into the night until Horace, Sarah's older brother, complained of the noise, as he was separated from them only by a partition. Helen wrote that, quote, "He was impolite enough to tell us of it and request us to stop and let him go to sleep, which was proof enough that he never thought of me, only as the green schoolgirl that I was." end quote. Of course, she later married Horace. Okay, so in 1842, Joseph Smith was developing and disseminating his Nauvoo theology. Exaltation, eternal marriage, eternal linking of families, and full practice of polygamy. So Heber Kimball, an apostle, was in this inner circle, and he became one of Smith's most devoted disciples and accepted these revelations, though polygamy tried him almost beyond endurance. Polygamy would also be a bitter test for Vallette. Because of it, writes Helen, her mother's trials, which she flattered herself were nearly over, had scarcely begun. Heber and Vallette were intensely devoted to each other, and to share that devotion with others would be an ultimate test. So the first chapter in this story is the test of Heber and Vallette, which is the well-known story in which Joseph Smith asked Heber to give Vallette to him as his wife. And so even though Heber usually accepted Joseph Smith's commandments without any question, he endured agonies for 3 days. But then Helen Marr's son, Orson Whitney, wrote, "Then with a broken and bleeding heart, but with soul self-mastered for the sacrifice, he led his darling wife to the prophet's house and presented her to Joseph. Joseph wept at this proof of devotion, and embracing Heber, told him that was all the Lord required. It had been a test, said Joseph, to see if Heber would give up everything he possessed. Then Joseph reportedly married Vallette and Heber for eternity, and said, 'Brother Heber, take her, and the Lord will give you 100-fold. So this prefigured the next test. Joseph Smith required that Heber take a plural wife. And in addition, he required that he keep it secret from Vallette, that he not tell Vallette that he was taking this plural wife. So, as if that weren't enough, Heber picked two women who he felt would not bother Vallette, two elderly ladies, the Pitkin sisters. But then Smith said, "No, I want you to marry Sarah Peak Noon." So he even gave them the person to marry. And Helen wrote, "This was the greatest test of Heber's faith that he had ever experienced. The thought of deceiving the kind and faithful wife of his youth, whom he loved with all his heart, and who with him had borne so patiently their separation, and all the trials and sacrifices they had been called to endure, was more than he felt able to bear." So once again, he went through agonies alone. However, when he balked, according to Orson Whitney, quote, "Heber was told by Joseph if he did not do this, he would lose his apostleship and be damned." So, he nevertheless married Sarah Peak Noon in early 1842 without telling Vallette. However, I imagine he worried that it's hard to keep these things secret, that Vallette would find out about it. So he displayed anxious and haggard looks. He was sick. He could not sleep. He would wring his hands and weep like a child. Vallette was mystified. According to family traditions, he asked God to reveal the principle to Vallette, and soon after, according to Helen, Vallette saw a vision of immortal joy in celestial plural marriage and saw Sarah Noon as Heber's wife. Vallette came to Heber and told him, "Heber, what you kept from me, the Lord has shown me." So according to this story, more was going on than this, but according to this story, she accepted polygamy at that point. Other things that were written by Helen make us realize that it was still very, very difficult for her. She had not accepted it completely emotionally. So their next trial involved Helen. And as Helen tells the story, polygamy entered her life overtly when her father approached her one day in the summer of 1843. "Without any preliminaries, my father asked me if I would believe him if he told me it was right for married men to take other wives." Helen's response was instinctual Victorian. Quote, "The first impulse was anger." And this is remarkable considering how she felt about her father. Quote, "My sensibilities were painfully touched. I felt such a sense of personal injury and displeasure, for to mention such a thing to me, I thought altogether unworthy of my father. And quick as he spoke, I replied to him shortly and emphatically, 'No, I wouldn't,' underlined. This was the first time I ever openly manifested anger towards him. Heber responded, apparently very low-key, and began teaching her the principle of plural marriage. Quote, "Then he commenced talking seriously and reasoned and explained the principle and why it was again to be established upon the earth, etc." Helen listened in disbelief and complete dismay. Elsewhere, she wrote that for her, this first interview had a similar effect to a sudden shock of a small earthquake. When he found out, after the first outburst of displeasure for the supposed injury that I received it meekly, he took the first opportunity to introduce Sarah Ann Whitney to me as Joseph's wife. And Sarah Ann was her best friend, who was around 18 or 19 at this point. This astonished me beyond measure. And so at this point, he hadn't introduced her as a possible wife in polygamy. He had just introduced the principle of polygamy, which she had reacted against with such great anger. And in 1881 reminiscence, Helen wrote, quote, "Having a great desire to be connected with the prophet Joseph, he, Heber, offered me to him. This I afterwards learned from the prophet's own mouth. My father had but one ewe lamb, but willingly laid her upon the altar. How cruel this seemed to the mother whose heartstrings were already stretched until they were ready to snap asunder. For he had taken Sarah Noon to wife, and she thought she had made sufficient sacrifice, but the Lord required more." Helen thus ended his first interview with Helen by asking her if she would become Joseph Smith's wife. If possible, Helen was even more astounded than she had been before. And remember, she's 14 years old at this point. She wrote, "I will pass over the temptations which I had during the 24 hours after my father introduced to me this principle and asked me if I would be sealed to Joseph." So apparently there was even some kind of 24-hour time period there. She wrote, "He left me to reflect upon it for the next 24 hours. I was skeptical. One minute believed, then doubted. I thought of the love and tenderness that he felt for his only daughter, and I knew that he would not cast her off, and this was the only convincing proof that I had of its being right. I knew that he loved me too well to teach me anything that was not strictly pure, virtuous, and exalting in its tendencies. And no one else could have influenced me at that time or brought me to accept of a doctrine so utterly repugnant and so contrary to all of our former ideas and traditions." And it's interesting, she, in her talking about how she accepted polygamy, she never talks about how she accepted it because Joseph Smith was an infallible prophet. It was always because my father taught it to me. The next morning, Joseph himself appeared in the Kimball home and personally explained the principle of celestial marriage to Helen. In her memoir, Helen wrote, quote, "After which he said to me, 'If you will take this step, it will ensure your eternal salvation and exaltation and that of your father's household and all of your kindred. This promise was so great that I willingly gave myself to purchase so glorious a reward.'" As in the case of Sarah Whitney, Smith gave the teenage daughter responsibility not only for her own salvation, but for that of her whole family. Thus, her acceptance of a plural marriage that was not intrinsically attractive to her was an act of youthful sacrifice and heroism. The only person still reluctant to see the marriage performed after Helen had accepted the proposal was Valette. Helen wrote, "None but God and his angels could see my mother's bleeding heart when Joseph asked her if she was willing. She replied, 'If Helen is willing, I have nothing more to say.' This is not a glowingly positive bestowal of permission." Helen conjectures that Valette was thinking of her own trials as a plural wife. Helen wrote, "She had witnessed the sufferings of others who were older and who better understood the step they were taking, i.e. Valette herself. And to see her child, who had scarcely seen her 15th summer, following in the same thorny path, in her mind she saw the misery which was as sure to come as the sun was to rise and set. But it was all hidden from me." So despite Valette's obvious reluctance to see her daughter marry polygamously, the ceremony took place. In May 1843, Helen was married to Joseph Smith. The houses of Joseph Smith and Heber Kimball were eternally linked together. Helen's reminiscences include a poem that give us a valuable insight into her feelings at the time. Unlike Eliza Snow, who looked upon the marriage to Joseph Smith as the spiritual zenith of her life, Helen, much younger, saw it as limiting her freedom and isolating her from her friends. The poem appears to open with Helen describing her perspective when she married Smith. "I thought through this life my time will be my own. The step I am now am taking's for eternity alone. No one need be wiser. Through time I shall be free, and as the past hath been, the future still will be. To my guileless heart, all free from worldly care, and full of blissful hopes and youthful visions rare, the world seemed bright, the threatening clouds were kept from sight, and all looked fair." Though the interpretation of these lines has been debated, it appears that Helen, when she married Smith, understood that the marriage would be for eternity alone, and that it would leave her free to marry someone else for time. But apparently this was not actually the case. A number of factors argue against the interpretation that Helen married to Joseph Smith for eternity alone. First is, there is no evidence elsewhere that Joseph Smith ever married for eternity only. The other marriages we know of were for marriage for time and eternity, including Sarah Ann Whitney's marriage, which is a good parallel to Helen Marr's marriage. And we actually have the marriage ceremony for Sarah Ann Whitney's marriage. Secondly, Helen's later history shows that Joseph was protective of her, as he had been with another young wife, Flora Ann Woodworth, and shielded her from the attentions of other young men. This would not be consistent with marriage for eternity only. Third, the rest of the poem shows that Helen's blissful hopes of teenage romantic freedom were dashed. She had misunderstood the meaning of the marriage to Smith. Quote, "But pitying angels wept. They saw my youthful friends grow shy and cold, and poisonous darts from slanderous tongues were hurled. Untutored heart, in thy generous sacrifice, thou didst not weigh the cost, nor know the bitter price. Thy happy dreams, all o'er, thou'st doomed, alas, to be boxed out from social scenes by this thy destiny. And o'er thy saddened memories of sweet departed joys, thy sickened heart will brood and imagine future woes. And like a fettered bird with wild and longing heart, thou'lt daily pine for freedom and murmur at thy lot." So apparently Helen had expected her marriage to Joseph Smith to be for eternity only, but then discovered that it included time too. These lines present a bleak picture of Helen's mental state in the months after the marriage. A sickened heart broods. She is a fettered bird with wild and longing heart who pines for freedom every day. One imagines she had infatuations with boys her own age, and perhaps she had already become emotionally attached to Horace Whitney. The marriage to Smith, coming so suddenly and blocking these growing feelings, must have been devastating to her. These lines are the first evidence for depression in Helen Marr's life. Despite her alienation from some of her friends, her friendship with Sarah Ann deepened. The poem then looks forward to the afterlife and the glorious crown she would receive in the next life. The poem ends with a tribute to her father. "But had this not come through my dear father's mouth, I should never have received it as God's sacred truth." So Heber left Nauvoo on a mission. Helen was left to continue her teenage years. The one important incident, there were weekly parties at Joseph Smith's mansion house, and once William Kimball was allowed to go, and Helen wanted to go with William, and Joseph Smith instructed Heber that he didn't think it would be a good idea for Helen to go. And Helen was upset and depressed at being kept home and even felt feelings of rebellion and resentment against her father. Quote, "I felt quite sore over it and thought it a very unkind act in father to allow William to go and enjoy the dance unrestrained with others of my companions and fetter me down, for no girl loved dancing better than I did. And I really felt that it was too much to bear. It made the dull school more dull. And like a wild bird, I longed for the freedom that was denied me and thought myself an abused child and that it was pardonable if I did murmur." Helen apparently came to realize that she was married to Joseph Smith for time as well as for eternity. A severe depression ensued. She felt that her life's happiness had ended completely and, quote, "she brooded over the sad memories of sweet departed joys and all manner of future woes." However, her marriage to Joseph Smith ended abruptly when he was killed, June 27, 1844, which opened another chapter in her life. Brigham Young, of course, became president of the church. Heber C. Kimball became his counselor, the second most powerful man in the church. In addition, beginning on September 10, 1845, Heber, with Brigham Young, began marrying a number of plural wives, from September 10th, 1844 to February 1846, Heber married some 35 women, many without informing Belait. Single once more, Helen could rejoin her normal peer group, and she began dating Horace Whitney. And they were married just before the Mormons took off on their trip west, and they were married in the Nauvoo Temple on February 3rd, 1846. However, she was married for eternity to Joseph Smith, so Horace Whitney stood proxy for Joseph Smith in the marriage for eternity. Then they were married for time. This left Horace without an eternal companion, and so Helen stood proxy for a dead woman, as Horace was married to a dead woman for eternity. And part of the dynamics of this kind of marriage was all of the children through this marriage would be Joseph Smith's for eternity, not Horace's. So it was kind of a paradoxical marriage. But in reading about the marriage, you get the idea that they were very, very much in love. And they had their honeymoon crossing the plains. We had doors generally cut on the left side of the wagon covers. Helen describes her pioneer household. Boxes and bags of grain were packed in the rear part of our wagon, upon which our bed was made. We had our provision chest in front, which served as a table, and between was just room for my chair, this being my only piece of furniture, the most of our household chattels being left in our house in Nauvoo. I could now knit and read as we traveled, and Horace could read or play his flute as he liked. And none, I think, but those who had a like experience can form the slightest idea of the appreciation and happiness it gave us to have a little wagon all to ourselves, which, under the circumstances, was next thing to paradise. And I like a description of a day they had, a day off, a Sunday, and Horace went fishing all day and took his books and read, and she took her books and read and enjoyed the landscape, the variety of hills and dales. So they had a wonderful quasi-honeymoon as they were crossing the plains. Halfway across, Heber C. Kimball asked them to share their tent with five other people, so that was the end of the honeymoon, but they were very much in love, I think. However, she began to have a difficult pregnancy in winter quarters. So she was bedridden from January 23, 1847 until March, became very sick. In her room, to keep these primitive houses warm, you had to have fire going, and the fireplace arrangements were often not very good, so the rooms became smoky. So it was not a good environment for someone who was very sick. And Helen wrote, "It gave me the opportunity of cultivating the qualities of patience and calmness, from which there was no alternative, only to endure them with as good grace as possible. However, she wept many times during the smoking period," as she called it. As Helen's first childbirth approached, Horace was called to leave with the first group of pioneers. So he was gone when she had her child, and it was born stillborn. And she wrote on the death of this child that the child, the only bright star to which my doting heart had clung, was snatched away. And it seemed a needless bereavement and most cruel. In a letter to Horace, she wrote, "I have passed through various trying scenes since you left. I have been called to part with my little babe, which has been harder to bear than all my bodily suffering, although that has been very great." And in my readings on depression, often grief can trigger depression, and normally you grieve for something like a 6 month period, but people who have a tendency toward depression continue grieving after the 6 month period. And so this kind of experience put her in danger. Horace came back and they got ready to cross the plains again. She was pregnant again, 19 years old at this time. After the ordeal of pioneer pregnancy, once again, childbirth brought tragedy. On August 17, 1848, on the Sweetwater River, 1 mile west of Sage Creek in western Wyoming, she bore her second child, a boy, William Howard. But after the birth, she remained very sick, pretty meek, diagnosed fallen uterus. Then little William died on the 22nd. Helen's 20th birthday, a cruel coincidence. Compounded with this blow was Helen's continuing illness. 2 days later, the whole camp stopped because of her condition, a rarity in Mormon pioneering. So she did not get better. She got to Salt Lake City, and everyone expected her to die. I had talked with my husband and father, who were weeping as I took a parting kiss from all but my poor mother, who was the last one called and had sunk upon her knees before me. This distressed me, but I bade her not mourn, for she would not be long behind me. My words struck Father like a sudden thunderbolt, and he spoke with a mighty voice and said, "Valet, Helen is not dying." But my breath, which by this time had nearly gone, stopped that very instant, and I felt his faith and knew that he was holding me. And I begged him to let me go, as I thought it was very cruel to keep me. The destroyer was then stirred up in anger at being cheated out of his victim, and he seemed determined to wreak his vengeance upon us all. No one but God and his angels could know the tenth part of what I suffered. And this, the reference to the destroyer here reminds us that they looked upon sickness often as the attack of Satan. And she herself, in her other writings, she felt that she was being attacked by evil spirits at this time, Gadianton robbers who had inhabited the plains that they'd passed through. And she felt that they were given power to attack her because, for two reasons. One, because she hated the principle of polygamy, and two, because she had had an extreme love for her last baby. "I had loved my baby more than my God and mourned for it unreasonably." She wrote, "For 3 months I lay a portion of the time like one dead, they told me." So in her soul she wrestled with this hatred of polygamy. "All my sins and shortcomings were magnified before my eyes till I believed I had sinned belong beyond redemption. During that season I lost my speech, forgot the names of everybody and everything, and was living in another sphere. I was left a poor wreck of what I had been." So finally, around Christmas 1848, she wrote, "I had my last struggle and resolved that they, the spirits, should buffet me no longer. I fasted for 1 week, and every day I gained till I had won the victory, and I was just as sensible of the presence of holy spirits around my bedside as I had been of the evil ones." So she had been converted to polygamy. She felt elated and had one of the happiest days of her life, and immediately called her mother to her bedside to try to convert her to polygamy. Helen wrote, "I knew her heart was weighed down in sorrow. I never before spoke with such eloquence, and she knew that it was not myself. She was so affected that she sobbed till I ceased. I assured her that Father loved her, but he had a work to do. She must rise above her feelings and seek for the Holy Comforter, and though it rent her heart, she must uphold him, for he in taking other wives had done it only in obedience to a holy principle. Much more I said, and when I ceased, she wiped her eyes. I silently prayed to be renewed when my strength returned that instant." So she regained her health, and people who met her again felt that she had been one who had been dead and resurrected. And so I'm not going to tell you the rest of her story. We're going to end at that conversion. But just to add this, at this point, she had not yet reached the age of 21. Very eventful life at that point. In her later life, she did go on to have children that lived. She lost her first three. And her husband went on to marry two other wives, and one of these wives, Mary Kravath, had 13 children, but the two households evidently lived in peace. There were no overt tensions. Helen, in her later life, wrote two pamphlets defending the principle, Why We Practice Plural Marriage and Plural Marriage as Taught by the Prophet Joseph. This last is a good example of putting your thesis right in the title. For it was written to counter RLDS claims that Joseph Smith never practiced polygamy. She wrote a poem in this last pamphlet that ends, that even attacked monogamy. "And down with wayward Rome's economy, parent of nameless ills, monogamy, concomitant of empire crumbling vice, immolating virtue at the shrine of price. Let innocence no more be child of shame. Let nature's needs the laws of nature frame. Let nature vows be honorable in all, untrammeled by a monogamic wall of selfishness and rank hypocrisy, the gift of pagan aristocracy." So ended a spiritual odyssey that began with an explosion of anger against her father and a long period of hating polygamy in her heart. Evaluating Helen's conversion to polygamy is difficult. and perhaps depends on whether you think Nauvoo polygamy was inspired of God or not. And as I finish, I just want to leave you with questions to think about. If you believe that polygamy was revealed directly from God, then this is simply an Orthodox faith-promoting story. But if you believe that it was practiced in a way that shows the human failings of the participants, then we sympathize with the early rebellious Helen and look at her father and mother as flawed in allowing, even putting pressure on their daughter to marry an older man as a polygamous wife. I think that the evidence is that Heber Kimball was essentially a good man and father, and that Blake was also a wonderful person. But they participated in an arrangement that put Helen Marr in a hastily thrown together marriage that left her feeling depressed, trapped, and deeply resentful toward polygamy, just as she was entering her difficult teenage years. Why did she later make her conversion to the principle she hated? Setting the absolutist pro-polygamy interpretation to the side, I think the answer has to be Helen finally accepted polygamy out of loyalty to her father, to her ethnic culture, to the idea of a living, infallible prophet, Joseph Smith. If she rejected polygamy, she would have had to reject her father, her people, and even her sisters who had accepted polygamy and had sacrificed a lot for it. She was too interwoven into the loving but forceful web of Mormon culture and society. These issues may not have been consciously analytically examined by her, but when she was lying in a death-like sickness and believed that she was attacked by evil spirits, she felt that God had abandoned her to them because she had opposed the priesthood on the issue of polygamy. Her guilt and fear were enormous, and she had to accept polygamy wholeheartedly to regain her life, her family, and her people. In looking at this story, these issues face us still. If we reject Joseph Smith's polygamy, are we rejecting the woof and web of the fabric called Mormonism, which has so much good in it? Or if we reject Joseph Smith's polygamy, are we being even more loyal to the highest principles of Mormonism? If we severely humanize Joseph Smith, are we being disloyal or profoundly loyal to our heritage? So in my cowardly way as a historian, I pose these questions without answering them and leave them echoing in your mind. Thank you.
God is so calm and so even-tempered, so I think that's why they've got me responding to this paper, because I was not calm at all reading this lady's life. He sent me his paper quite some time ago, which is really rare for a Sunstone presenter. And I began reading it, and I realized I got to make a chronology, because so much is crowded into a life. So much happens to this lady before she's even 21. She marries Joseph Smith at 14. She is a young thing. So there are three points that I want to make. The first point I want to make is how Joseph Smith takes an elite set of families and brings them in and totally commits them to what he is doing. So they really don't have, from their point of view, they don't see a choice. You see him sending Helen's father, Heber, on missions left and right. Heber's going to the eastern states. He's going to England. He goes to England again. One time he goes on a mission. He is so sick, he can't even sit up in the wagon. That's how sick he is. And Helen, who is so close to Valate, is watching. She's very close to Valate. She's the only daughter. She raises Valate's children with her. She sees that Valate is in pain because of this. So Heber's going off on these missions left and right. There's one part in Helen's diary where Heber comes back from a mission, and Valate is right there, and Valate's beginning to resent Joseph Smith because he doesn't leave. He comes with Heber to the end of town and rides with him back to the house, and then he stays, and he stays that evening, and he keeps staying. And Valate, who hasn't seen her husband in some time, loves the prophet but resents the prophet, and Helen is picking up on all that. She's a very intuitive girl. At one point, Joseph Smith has Heber move closer to him because he wants Heber right there. So you can imagine Valate is having a hard time with sharing her husband so closely with Joseph Smith, who is just oblivious of Valate's needs as a wife, as a mother, as a human being. Then he puts upon Heber and Valate the test. Okay, Heber, you need to give me your wife. and that test is just excruciating for both of them. They suffer. This is a difficult part for them. They don't know whether to accept this or not accept this. And when they finally struggle and make their decision, Joseph Smith says, "Oh, it was just a test, and you passed. Good for you." Phew, that test is over with. And then the harder test comes. We want your 14-year-old daughter. And before Heber ever approaches his daughter, he's already promised her to Joseph. And what else can Helen do? Because Joseph and Heber have both told this 14-year-old girl, not only is your salvation is at stake, the salvation of the whole your whole extended family is at stake. And if you don't make this choice, you're going to be condemned. What else can she do? Of course she marries him. Now, one part where Todd and I have a different point of view is Todd's, I think in Todd's paper, he's saying this was a marriage for time. And I think my point of view is toward the end of his life, Joseph Smith's theology was developing so rapidly and he was getting so many different ideas. It wasn't until later that we began sorting them out into nice categories: marriage for time, marriage for eternity, marriage for dynastic reasons. I think it's my point of view that Joseph Smith, didn't really understand all the implications. He wanted the two families to be joined together. Doing it with a 14-year-old made a lot of sense. The two families could be joined. I think from Helen's point of view, she was going through a ceremony. But at the same time, if you look at that whole community, the community was being persecuted at that time. There were rumors of polygamy. There was a lot of Mormon tracts at that time about, we don't practice polygamy, that's not us, to counteract those rumors. And Helen, who was a very smart, intuitive girl, she's aware of those rumors. And in that poem she writes when she's 14 that Todd reads to you, she talks about the gossiping tongues. She talks about the friends that become cruel to her. She knows that she's an object of gossip. And it's not just, and your normal 14-year-old girl thinks that the whole world is gossiping about them. But in her case, it's true. The whole community is. And it's not just idle gossip. This is gossip that's going to result in arrests and persecution and having to leave town. This is pretty serious business that's on her back. And so no wonder this girl is feeling depressed about this marriage. And then whether it is time or eternity, it turns out that parents and Joseph Smith feel the need to be protective of her and a little bit possessive. She can't go to parties anymore if the community is talking about her, if there's persecution. She can't go to social events or parties or anything else. And that's a tough thing for a 14-year-old. So when she's 15, Joseph is martyred. She loses him. We don't get a lot of grief from her diaries. We get that she's very close to Heber. She's very close to Valade. We get that she is sad that the prophet has died, but we don't get the sense, oh, my husband's died. That's certainly not how she sees the world. And she does become converted to polygamy in the wagon when she's sick. And I want to put into context for you. The first baby dies, is born stillborn. Her second baby lives for 5 days. And she holds that baby, and he dies after 5 days. And this conversion happens 1 month later. And she's chastising herself because she loved that baby too much. And I'm reading that thinking, how can you love a baby too much? I don't get this. She is mourning for this baby. And she's already been beset many times with depression. And when she describes her depression, she describes it as a choice between life or death. And particularly as she gets older, she sees death as something very welcoming. There are many people that she loves that are on the other side of the veil. I think it's sort of how many of us feel now in this day of AIDS, where we have so many friends on this side than on this side. And so whenever she was in a fit of depression, it was, well, do I embrace life? Living, or do I yearn and long for this death, which to me is an escape, it's a release, I will be with my loved ones. And so when she's in the wagon and she's dying and all her family has said goodbye to her, and Heber, her father, screams out to Valade, she is not dying, and that kind of snaps her out of it. And at that point she determines, I'm going to embrace life. And for her, in the wagon with all the saints, with all that they've committed to embrace life. You got to embrace polygamy. That's her point of view, and so she does it. And again, I'm going to take issue with Todd about she lives next door to her plural wife with no apparent tensions. I don't know about that. She's got some tensions. This is a lady who has always needed her space. You read about when she and Horace get their wagon and go on their little honeymoon because they're in a wagon together. And they're not going anywhere. They're following the other saints. But for two whole weeks, the two of them get a wagon together, and she thinks that's pretty romantic. And their honeymoon ends after 2 weeks when she has to share the tent. Later on, her husband Horace takes on a wife. And I tell Todd, do you know that she was 4 months pregnant when he was dating this woman? Which she was. He loses no time in pursuing wife number two. 1 month after her conversion, we see letters going back and forth between Helen and Horace about this woman that he's dating. And he's telling her, oh, I hope it doesn't hurt your feelings too much, but I do have these romantic and passionate feelings for this other woman, and I think I'm going to marry her. But just remember that I'm always going to tell you my deepest, darkest sorrows, so I'll still love you. Well, she's going to be depressed about that. He marries this woman, and Helen, she's a survivor. She makes the best of it, and the woman gets pregnant. And the woman dies in childbirth. And so then Helen has another baby in her arms. And 22 days later, that baby dies. And she's still, she's still 21 at that time? She's still very, very young. They get to the valley. And Horace marries another woman. And they set up in a house right at the opening of City Creek. And the woman lives under Helen's roof until she has three kids. So I'm thinking the two wives live under the same roof for 3 to 5 years. And then Horace built the house right next door to her. And they live next door. And she's a trooper. She puts up with it. But you get a little bit of tension about the children and the noise. This is a lady who's a writer. She likes to be alone. She's an artist. She can deal with her kids. But the extra noise and the tension is a lot for this lady. And at one point, when the sister wife is getting her house improved, they all move in to Helen's house, and she goes nuts. She really does go nuts. She calls it nervous prostration. I call it she goes nuts. She tells Horace, "This is it. I can't deal with this. You need to get me a house. We can't afford it. We're poor. No way. No how. You've got to live with the spirit." And she just prevails upon him, and he builds her house, not on the same lot, but out there. Oh, I think it's over in the avenues. They both live in 18th Ward. But she does get her own space. And later on, when she's an older lady, when she's in her 50, 51, 52, she talks about being friends with all these women, but she says, there's one woman who's really mad at me because I won't give up my writing room. And I think it's got to be wife number two who wants Helen to take someone in or take a child in or whatever. But Helen is a trooper, but she does need her own space. Polygamy is tough for her. She does end up writing the two pamphlets about why Joseph Smith preached plural marriage. At the time she writes those pamphlets, Joseph Smith has been dead for 40 years. There are fewer and fewer people alive who are still connected with Joseph Smith. And here she is, one of his wives. So she has attained an elite place in Mormondom. And she has some amount of stature for herself, for her writings that are appearing in Exponent. And she does become a defender. Writing becomes an outlet for her. She's proud of her writing. It's something that she can do. And she can explain. And again, she has become the object of a lot of gossip and innuendo and political fighting. Because at this point, this is just 2 years before the manifesto. Isn't it 2 years before the manifesto when she writes her pamphlets is shortly before the manifesto. So you know there are a lot of tensions in Utah about becoming a state, about polygamy. You got the Smoot trials going on in the Senate. And so again, she's an object, not just her, but her and her lifestyle and her church are an object of gossip and innuendo. But the difference is she's not 14 anymore. She's an older, mature woman who's given her life to this, and she can write. She's now in a position to defend herself, which she does beautifully, in which the church, she doesn't have to hide this anymore, and the church gives her kudos for doing that. So she's just a remarkable woman. I loved reading the paper. I loved finding out more about her. This is a lady who put up with a lot and who wasn't what we normally call pioneer stock, just incredibly tough women. She was sick. Her pregnancies were tough for her. She was depressed. She was sick a lot. Her body really wasn't made for bearing all those children and crossing the plains and working as hard as she did, and she tells you about it. So she tells you the real human and emotional expense and cost of being a Mormon during this very interesting time. And I think Todd has really accomplished quite a bit in putting this together for us. Thank you very much.
Okay, this person, Violet, has asked about, mentioned that Joseph Smith sent Horace Kimball on a mission, Horace Whitney on a mission. Kimball's Whitney's are almost the same, you know. Soon after he had married Horace's sister, Sarah Ann Whitney. And this is interesting, I hadn't thought of it in context of Helen Marr's marriage, but I dealt with it in the chapter on Sarah Ann Whitney. But that's the one, you know, perfect proof of the fact that Joseph Smith did use missions to get men, relatives of the women he married, out of the way when he married them. And Helen Marr says this was his motivation. He thought Horace might object to the marriage to Sarah Ann Whitney, so he sent him on a mission. And so that allows us to interpret some of the other missions that he sent relatives of Joseph Smith's plural wives on. But I'd have to look at the exact chronology to see if I thought it had an impact on Helen Marr, but that's a really good possibility that I'll follow up on. Thanks. Comments? Go ahead.
Was Emma Smith always aware of Joseph's liaisons? I mean, she was suffering from depression too, I take it.
There's good proof that often she did not know of Joseph Smith's plural marriages. But I think she was very perceptive, and she began to be very adept at noticing Joseph Smith's attentions to women and guessing that here's a plural marriage. So that's all I know.
I agree that he didn't always tell her, and I think some clear evidence of that is when he's telling Heber to take on his first plural wife. He says, he instructs Heber, do not tell Valette about this. So that clearly shows he's already encountered angry women who are not happy about polygamy. So I agree, but Emma wasn't stupid. Emma could figure out when things were going on. Yes?
Well, there's some sources that say that say what is the source? Was it in Wild Mormon Portraits that says that Emma sent Eliza Snow to spy on Joseph Smith, And so Joseph Smith found out about it, so he married Eliza Snow to keep her quiet. And I don't know. I don't know how to deal with that. But
early dynamics of the Relief Society in this context, it becomes pretty amazing.
You sound like you've done some research on that, Susan.
Well, I mean, I have, and that's one thing that strikes me is that how strategically it ends up that by marrying certain women, it keeps Emma or other people from finding out, or it regulates the flow of information among the women. And I think it's interesting that in her
How can I repeat all this? This is all very interesting. Susan Staker is talking about how Joseph Smith would marry certain women strategically, kind of to co-opt them into the polygamy culture, I guess you would call it, and to keep gossip down. And she talks about the Relief Society as possibly being involved with that. So we look forward to your publication. One other possibility is he married Sylvia Sessions, and her mother was Patty Sessions, who knew just about everything that was going on in Mormonism. There's no way to keep Patty Sessions from knowing about her daughter's marriage. And so a month later, he marries Patty Sessions. And so you could see that as co-opting the mother into the culture, and one reason why he would marry an older woman. Yes?
How many women rejected polygamous advances from Joseph Smith? I'm aware of Cindy Rickman's daughter, Nancy, and apparently Sarah Bates Pratt. Or how many others are you aware of?
In my article that was published in Dialogue, which will be the prologue to my book, I in one of my footnotes, I list a bunch, all that I could find, from both sympathetic and unsympathetic sources. What was it? You know, maybe I would say 10, but go add them up in my paper. But my favorite story is he started preaching the principle of plural marriage to Sarah Kimball, who was married to another man, and which usually means he's going to propose to her. And she told him, she said, "I told him to go preach polygamy to someone else." And she was a good, faithful member and continued to be a good, faithful member. But she put her foot down there. Yes, but he started way back in Nauvoo. He married a number of Joseph Smith's widows. He and Heber C. Kimball married a number, about 10 each, of Joseph Smith's widows in 1844 and 1845. And you read the family accounts, and they pose it like this. They say Joseph Brigham and Heber felt it was so bad that Joseph Smith had not left a lot of actual children. And they felt it was their duty to marry these widows, to provide for them, and to provide actual children for Joseph Smith for the eternities. Yes, according to the whole system as they set it up. However, other people interpret it as he was trying to consolidate his power by marrying Joseph Smith's widows. And Mike Quinn, in his Mormon Hierarchy book, he pursues that theory. And both may be true. There may be mixed motives. Gary?
I find myself, and I probably really haven't realized it, things that we don't understand and all these strange things. And at the same time, I realize that if we were to read today contemporary religious movement that had a charismatic leader, the same kinds of things that Joseph Smith did in regards to polygamy among members of this group, that my reaction would be completely different than how I feel about Joseph Smith. And I'm sure the reaction generally would be considerably different, especially to non-members of that group, you know, all the way from disapproval to legal action and things like that. So there's a certain amount of dissonance reduction that I go through in dealing with the material that you present. And I wonder if you could talk about your own experiences with that.
Yeah, these are very interesting questions, and as I say, I ended my paper in a cowardly way, but in another way, you could just say I didn't have time. It would take another hour to talk about, especially my autobiographical responses. Well, I view all of religion, but early Mormon history and the people in early Mormon history as very human. I don't have an absolutist view. I don't see Joseph Smith receiving inerrant revelation, and it's easy to say that. That sounds like an easy liberal thing to say. You can still be faith-promoting and say that. But once you say that, it's very dangerous. I mean, where do you draw the line as to what was not revelation? You know, when Joseph Smith says to a woman, God has given you to me, you know, and an angel has proposed it to me, if you have an inerrant absolutist view of Joseph Smith, you have to accept that. If you see him as a human being, it's very problematic that he would use that method in recruiting that woman into his family. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I want to hear what Martha has to say on that. She had some ideas, I think.
Well, the one contemporary example I can think of, and this has been in the newspaper, so I'm not disclosing anything confidential, is the self-proclaimed prophet Cheney, who was arrested for giving his 13-year-old daughter over to a 40-year-old man to marry. Now, how we handle that these days is that daughter was placed in foster care. But what you need to know, and this has been in the papers, is that family, that extended family, had moved from several states. And the social services in each of these different states had been approached about taking that little girl into foster care. But it wasn't until they got to Utah that our law was aggressive enough and we were outraged enough that we did take that little girl into foster care. And we're saying, no, you don't marry off a 13-year-old. We call that rape. So, yes, we have, our point of view has changed quite a bit, and that's an example of that.
Why don't we close formally, and if you have further questions, maybe you can approach the podium. Thank you.